the least attainable and most dangerous places on Earth. Touching the edge of heaven, it towers more than 8 kilometres above the face of the globe. Around its summit roar the fierce winds of the jet stream. The Tibetans know this place as Jomalungma, Goddess Mother of the World, while in Nepal it's called Sagarmatha, Goddess of the Sky. To the rest of us, it's the mountain we know as Everest.
Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service, presents Everest, the Coveted Mountain. The program is presented by James McDonald.
For many centuries, Jomalungma was a feared, sacred place, a mountain where no man dared to tread. The Sherpa people living in its shadow revered the mighty peak as a place where the gods resided. But in the 19th century, British colonial surveyors declared Jomalungma the highest peak in the world, and from that moment on, our relationship with the mountain changed. The gentlemen mountaineers of Europe were soon planning how they might conquer the peak. But it took another 100 years before a local Sherpa climber and a New Zealander reached the summit. Now 80 years old, Edmund Hillary lives in his native country in semi-retirement. But he maintains a close interest in the world of mountaineering and still views Everest with a great deal of respect.
It is the highest and greatest mountain in the world. Even though it has now been climbed many times, it also has an aura about it because I think some 180 people have actually died on the mountain. So it's certainly not a pushover, as it were. It's still a big challenge.
Sir Edmund Hillary reached the top of Everest in May 1953 with Tenzing Norgay, an experienced Sherpa climber. And the mountain changed their lives forever. The two men became heroes in their native countries and received many honours.
I believe that our successful ascent of the mountain stimulated certainly a lot of public interest, but also interest among mountaineers worldwide. So I suppose you could say our success certainly resulted in a great deal of interest in mountaineers all over the place, and it became almost the in thing, really, for mountaineers to want to head off and try and climb Mount Everest.
In the decades after the mountain was first conquered, only a few experienced climbers returned to Everest, tackling new and dangerous routes. But in recent years, increasing numbers of people have begun coming to the mountain. From all walks of life, some of them have never even stood high on a mountain before. For reasons perhaps not even known to themselves, they have an irresistible urge to tackle the world's highest peak.
When we climbed Everest, when we reached the summit, I firmly believed that mountaineers would lose interest in the mountain. Of course, I was absolutely wrong. Instead, it stimulated interest in climbing the mountain, not only by mountaineers, but by those who felt that they could reach the top and they could come home and boast about it.
Coming down from Everest, it gives you a lot of prestige, because most of the not climbing people, they think Everest is the highest, is the most difficult mountain, and each is running around like the warriors after the battle with something like, "I climbed Everest." Which kind of Everest?
Reinhold Messner is one of the greatest climbers of all time. 20 years ago, he stunned the world when, with a friend, Peter Habler, the two men climbed Everest without using bottled oxygen. It was hailed as the crowning achievement of mountaineering. The air at the top of Everest is so thin that just breathing, let alone climbing, becomes a real effort. Looking back at his achievement, Messner is glad that he had the chance to climb Everest at a time when relatively few people had been there.
We had this opportunity to go to Everest in a clean system. There was one permit for one expedition on one line.
Until Messner and Habler arrived on the scene, few people got to climb the Himalayan peaks. Expeditions were sponsored and chosen within the elite circles of mountaineering. Teams of men would lay siege to the mountain, carving a route up and carrying supplies of food and oxygen to progressively higher camps. What Habler and Messner did was to apply the climbing methods of their native Tyrol. Using a minimum of lightweight equipment, they raced up the mountain and down again, in the so-called Alpine style. It revolutionised the world of high-altitude climbing, opening up the Himalayan peaks to a whole new generation.
It was a flash of genius, more or less. I did a few 8,000-metre peak expeditions, being a member on classical expeditions, paying my part with somebody who had a permit and who decided where to go. And I understood this is not my way. I would like to go on my expedition and prepare my style and invent my route. And after this, I decided on Everest, the Alpine style is possible only if I do it without oxygen. When I did this the second time, it was really the biggest mountain I ever climbed, because I was so far away from human beings, from safety. Up there, there's nothing. It's only cold and hard climbing. It was physically the limit I could do.
In 1980, Messner climbed Everest solo, again without using oxygen. His achievements inspired climbers everywhere, some of whom now return to the mountain to follow in his footsteps.
I think that I give to many people a new possibility to climb with their own money the big mountains. But quite nobody followed my way. This is the crazy thing. All these ascents of the last years, also the solo ascents, the so-called solo ascents, all the speed ascents, it's all bullshit.
In the last few years, guiding companies have begun taking paying clients up Everest. For a fee of between $40,000 and $60,000, you'll be taken to the top of the world, following a trail of fixed ropes and sleeping in tents pitched for you along the way. Although it might sound like a lot of money, hundreds of people turn up every year to tackle the mountain in this way.
You know, the people who are being conducted to the summit, they don't really do any of the establishing of the route themselves. They mostly, on the icefall, are climbing up 60 aluminium ladders. There are thousands of feet of fixed rope, which they use to guide them. Even high on the mountain, there are always tracks made by other people, so they plod along in other people's tracks. So, in a sense, they're not really doing anything new. For them, it is still a considerable challenge because of the great altitude, but often they may be slow and not very experienced, and of course disaster has occurred.
It was in 1996 that one particular calamity caught the attention of the world's media. Two commercial expeditions were on the mountain, leading groups of clients from Japan, the United States and other Western countries. All seemed to be going well, until the two groups got caught high on the mountain in a storm. Among the clients being led up Everest that day was a journalist, John Krakauer. He was one of the first people to reach the mountain's summit that day, and wrote of his experiences in the best-selling book, Into Thin Air.
Straddling the top of the world, one foot in China and the other in Nepal, I cleared the ice from my oxygen mask, hunched a shoulder against the wind, and stared absently down at the vastness of Tibet. I understood on some dim, detached level that the sweep of earth beneath my feet was a spectacular sight. I'd been fantasizing about this moment and the release of emotion that would accompany it for many months. But now that I was finally here, actually standing on the summit of Mount Everest, I just couldn't summon the energy to care. Later, after six bodies had been located, after a search for two others had been abandoned, after surgeons had amputated the right hand of my teammate Beck Weathers, people would ask why, if the weather had begun to deteriorate, had climbers on the upper mountain not heeded the signs.
I got back to Kathmandu after the 96 tragedy and saw a Newsweek, Newsweek's plastered over all the shops saying, "Everest, an American tragedy." And so far, I can only count one American that was actually killed in that, in that tragedy. So the fact that there is satellite telephones and there's, internet, online services and so on and so forth, meant that everybody found out about it straight away.
Guy Cotter was a childhood friend of Rob Hall, one of the guides who died with his clients on the mountain. As the disaster unfolded, Guy arrived quickly at Everest Base Camp to coordinate a rescue attempt for the people stuck many thousands of metres above.
People are given the impression that mountain guiding companies are the only ones going up into this environment who lose people from their teams. The reality is that climbing at very high altitude is extremely dangerous.
Guy Cotter stresses that accidents occur on Everest every year, accidents which usually don't get reported. But in 1996, modern communications brought the events closer to a wider audience. Even so, the loss of many lives did nothing to put people off. New clients have been coming to Adventure Consultants ever since, the business continuing in Guy Cotter's hands.
When we do go for the summit, we get up about midnight, and it's about a 12-hour climb up to the summit, depending on, you know, what condition you're in and what the snow conditions are like and what the weather's like. So we leave in the dark, climb up the icy slopes.
Guy Cotter makes sure potential clients have a good idea of what lies ahead of them on the mountain. His company receives inquiries from all sorts of people wanting to climb Everest.
Yes, a great variety. I mean, we get a lot of inquiry from people. Some of them are people who have never climbed before and they're very inspired about wanting to climb, and they set a challenge even before they know what mountaineering is about. And then there are others who are very experienced mountaineers, some of them, you know, great climbers in their own right, who come to us. So we do get a big mixture of people.
Potential clients are put through a strict vetting procedure. They're checked for physical fitness, but also for the mental strength necessary to see them through an ascent. For the company, such checks are essential. After all, being stuck above 8,000 metres with the wrong client can quickly become a terrible liability.
You've got to treat mountaineering very cautiously. It's not a game that you can learn from your mistakes very easily. So, you know, I tend to take people through a progression before taking them to the bigger peaks.
But if companies like Adventure Consultants really did treat Everest with respect, should they be there at all? Every climbing season brings bottlenecks of people queuing to climb the ridges approaching the summit as the mountain gets more and more crowded. But the problems, says Guy Cotter, are caused as much as anything by natural factors.
Weather is a big factor in whether there's any crowding, especially up high on the mountain where we've heard about the bottleneck problem. And if there's long, bad weather periods, everybody tends to be making a summit attempt at the same time as soon as it clears up. And this is where the problems come about. However, these problems, you know, you can deal with. For example, in 1997, when we went up Everest, but we just staggered our departure time from South Col, arriving on the summit at 10 to 7 in the morning, and we're back down before most of the other groups had even got to the South Summit.
They are using the prestige Hillary or also myself have given to Everest, and they go home with this prestige. They don't go home and say, I did Everest in a commercial expedition. And maybe they're also right that they did Everest in the same way like Hillary did it.
Criticism could hardly come from a higher authority than Reinhold Messner. Whenever Messner speaks, the mountaineering world listens. But there's the beginnings of a rebellion. Guy Cotter insists that the times have changed, something that Messner's generation finds hard to accept.
This goes against the grain for a lot of the amateur types. A lot of them don't like this, and some of them get the impression that just Joe Bloggs is climbing the likes of Everest these days. And, you know, I think there's probably been a few situations where that might have happened, and I think, you know, that some people have become a bit upset by that.
If we have problems, avalanches, storms, many people will die because many people are up there. I am sure we will have once a tragedy of 50 people in one day. And all the world will say how it is possible, how it is possible. And the children and the women of this man, or also the husbands of this women staying up there dying, they will say it's terrible. But they should know that it's dangerous. If I go again on a high peak in this summer, I make my testament before. I know it's dangerous, and I have a lot of experience. I'm not anymore as strong like I was 20 years ago, and not anymore as quick. But anyway, I know it's always dangerous. Mm. Bigger the mountains, bigger the avalanches.
I hate limits and restrictions, particularly on the mountains, but I really think as far as Everest is concerned, for the government to limit very severely the number of expeditions that can climb on the mountain at the same time would be a very good thing.
A few years ago, Sir Edmund Hillary was among a number of people that advised the Nepalese government to limit the numbers of people climbing Mount Everest. By raising the cost of a climbing permit to $50,000, the mountain, they hoped, would be priced above the reach of all but a few. But people kept coming, more in fact than ever. Further price rises have been talked about, but Reinhold Messner doesn't think that would achieve anything.
I think the permit is quite expensive enough. You know that Hillary and myself were the first ones. When these commercial expeditions came up, we talked to the government, put up the permit, so maybe this bad kind of expeditions will be gone. But more people came. So the price is not so important. And I think it would not be right that only rich people can buy a passage on Everest. Close the mountain, they will never do it, because now, really, Everest is giving money. They have maybe now 20 expeditions on the south side, on Everest side. They get $50,000 for one permit. It means they will have $1.5-2 million. That's for a lot of money for Nepal. So they will never do it. They understood this is a money machine. Everest is now like money printing.
Yeah, man. We've made it.
It's May 1992, and an ecstatic Ronald Nahr reaches the summit of Mount Everest. Holding up a Dutch flag, he speaks by walkie-talkie to base camp.
Hello,
you made so good work.
Space on the roof of the world was tight that day, with another 30 climbers heading for the top. Not exactly the solitary achievement that he'd hoped for.
So at that time, my wife came and visited to the base camp. It's a picture of it. This is my climbing mate to the top.
Back in the comfort of his own home, Ronald Nahr talks me through the photograph albums of his previous expeditions to Everest. Despite being one of the Netherlands' best-known climbers, it took him 3 taxing attempts to reach the mountain's summit.
It's not just the fame of the mountain, but it's also the feeling this is the highest one. It's a little bit nature of mountaineering. We're trying to get the top, which is the highest point of a mountain area. So if you take the mountain area bigger, you want to still reach the highest point.
Every climbing season brings more and more people to Everest Base Camp, wanting to try their luck with the mountain. The cost of launching an expedition to Everest has dropped massively in recent years, bringing the mountain within the reach of many more people. And that's a good thing, says Ronald Nahr. In the past, you could only go there if you were selected by national committee.
Nowadays, you have a lot of young people, and they should all have the right to climb the mountain. 20, 30 years ago, there were in Holland 5,000 mountaineers, and now we have 11 times as much. Who am I, Ronald Nahr, to forbid other people to give a try to Mount Everest? We are not in the Stalin times. And if you don't want to meet people in mountains, phone me, and I can give you maybe 2,000 mountain tops where you won't meet other people. You know, it's so easy to find them. So it's everybody's own choice. So don't complain if you see colleagues there.
As Everest becomes a less solitary place, climbers will inevitably be confronted with difficult decisions, moral dilemmas. Nowadays, they're also being faced with a lack of respect for each other.
Sometimes you reach your tent in the evening, which you left a few days before there, and you see there are people from completely different nationalities sleeping there and saying they have an emergency situation. And in 92, there were some Russians sleeping in our tent. He said, yes, we are in an emergency. And we said, there's no emergency, up, out. And we just throw them out. And it's, of course, it's a little bit of risk which you have to take, but they can bring you in a quite dangerous situation.
When another team gets into difficulty, climbers are faced with stark choices. Should they risk their own lives and launch a rescue operation? Is a rescue operation even possible? And hardest of all, should an attempt at reaching the summit be abandoned? Or should the cries for help be ignored in order to continue to the top? It's a situation Ronald Naar found himself in one stormy night during his final push for the top.
We were camping in the beginning of May in a high altitude camp on Mount Everest. Besides us, there was an Indian camp, and in the middle of the night they had a problem. And we asked, what's your problem? And they said, well, we don't have a problem. We don't need any help. Now, then later in the night, we heard some more shouts, and we again offered to give them some help. And then they said, no, we have just one casualty. And my knowledge of English is so far that if you have a casualty, the guy is dead. And that was what we understood of them. The guy is dead. Okay.
The next morning, one of the Sherpa climbers in Naar's team announced he'd seen the dead man waving, which could surely mean only one thing: he was still alive. Speaking by radio to base camp, doctors there also concluded the man was still clinging to life, but looks alone were enough to convince Naar of the casualty's condition.
I saw clearly that it was a dead body. The other said it was a dead body. So we were a little bit confused what to do. We say, well, it's a dead body. The doctor down there said it should probably be living. And the Indian people, his partner, the guy who was there, said also, we left a dead guy. We had a small discussion about it. We decided, well, shall we look it or not look it? And, well, the weather was bad, so we decided to stay there. Later in the morning, three of our people said, we go down. And on the way going down, they went to the body and saw that it was a dead body, and he came down.
With that decision, Naar considered the episode closed. But back in Europe, not everybody accepted his version of events. He should have tried to help the Indian climber no matter what, said some people. And different versions of the event from his own teammates only added to the controversy about his actions.
What happens is that the people separate, and after 3 or 4 years, their minds transform what has happened.
The climbers on Everest no longer only pose a risk to themselves. These days, they're putting the mountain's environment under threat as well. Climbing teams generate tons of trash during a summit attempt. The once pristine slopes of Everest are soiled with human feces, dead batteries, empty oxygen bottles, and the corpses of the climbers who died there. Even Edmund Hillary admits that during his successful expedition in 1953, nobody even considered proper disposal of the waste.
We knew very little about environmental matters, and we heaved rubbish all around the place for the best of them, and left rubbish on the first rubbish that was on the South Col, some of it was left by us. It's perhaps understandable when you've spent a lot of time at extreme altitude, your only desire is to get back down the mountain again and back home to the family. And the thought of carrying down all the stuff you carried up is the last thing in your mind.
Despite the effort, attitudes towards waste disposal have changed. It began with some climbers taking their own steps to clean up after themselves. And now the government of Nepal offers financial incentives. A partial refund of money paid for the climbing permit will be given to those who carry out their own trash. Even during his attempts on Everest, Ronald Naar has seen a change in attitude.
When we were in 82, it was quite normal after the expedition that we took all the things which we left, food, package material, and we put it on a big mountain and we burned it. Nowadays, it's not a custom anymore to burn garbage. So you burn it and you take the material and you bring it back. So there's an enormous change of attitude.
But as one problem is solved, so new problems arise. Opening the Everest region to increasing numbers of climbers and tourists brings valuable money into China and Nepal. Ronald Na thinks the two governments will make even greater strides to exploit the mountain.
I expect that, especially from the Nepal side, you will get it more organized, that the government will say, well, we don't allow individual expeditions anymore, but we, as government of Nepal, organize it. So they make fixed camps everywhere. They do it in Russia nowadays, because nowadays everybody pitch his own tent on the south of Everest. So everyone bringing up a tent, after one day sleeping, they bring it down. So why not putting their fixed tent? Why not building their hut? It's much safer. It's also for environmental reasons. It's much more clear than how people have to behave there.
But other people bristle at the idea of turning Everest into some kind of high-altitude playground. Reinhold Messner is convinced all the attention that the mountain has received is misplaced.
Everest is only a thing made by media and made by a few not good climbers. They will always follow more and more the wrong climbing and not the right one. And so it will break apart. There will be the specialists, the real good ones. They will not have any followers. Maybe on the end they will not be any more able to finance the expedition. If you go up on Everest, the easy way, the crowded way, the parasitic way, I would call it, is a parasitic system to climb Everest. They do the books today.
Will Everest really break the mountaineering world apart? Has it set the sport back decades rather than moving it on? Can we save the mountain from the hordes of climbers now ascending its once empty ridges?
Now I think people will want to go on climbing Everest. It's still a considerable challenge. There's still great risks involved. So I'm rather afraid that Everest will become a challenge to people for many years yet.
And a challenge it is for the thousands of people still coming to pit their wits against Everest. People reading a book, watching a film, or even listening to the radio will become inspired by the mystique Everest has generated. But for Reinhold Messner, this will only bring more problems. Problems that can only be solved by looking at ourselves.
Only if we change, if the climbers changing, the mistakes we did, we climbers did the mistakes, not the government. The government is right if they try to get all the money possible. And the Sherpas, they are also interested in walking, in bringing people up, and they know to handle Everest. But we made the mistake. And we showed to a large public that we do not anymore know what is mountaineering. We show it on Everest. We are totally out of the right approach. Our attitude toward the mountains should change again.
But it might be too late to try and change attitudes. Everest's mystique seems secure in the minds of the public. And ironically, much of that was built up by the likes of Edmund Hillary and Reinhold Messner. They've enjoyed years of prestige for summiting on Everest. Why should they hold it as their own? Asks Guy Cotter.
The way I perceive it is that they sense a loss of adventure, which is, I think, entirely true. The Everest that they knew is very different to the Everest of today. However, when you look at the big picture, what's happening today is almost a direct result of what people like that initiated. They went off and climbed these mountains and wrote books about it, and people around the rest of the world went, wow, this is great, I'd love to go and do that too.
The days when the Sherpa people feared Mount Everest are long gone. These days, many Sherpas make a living from guiding the expeditions that come to climb the mountain. People from all over the world will continue coming to the Himalayas, drawn by a desire to scale the world's largest peak. But Jomalungma, the goddess mother of the world, still demands our respect.
You must treat the mountain with great respect, not only for your own safety and your own life, but because it is a magnificent mountain, it should not be polluted, it should be left as a beautiful mountain.
Everest, the coveted mountain, was presented by James MacDonald and produced with the help of Hans van Kechten in New Zealand. Technical production was by Werner van Peppen. This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.